During Edgar's long afternoon walks, he would inevitably pause at one spot along a remote stretch of windswept beach, one quarter of a mile up from his house. Looking inland, he would stare up at a grassy knoll above the pines, the highest sand dune between Cape Henry and the city limits. It was here, in his mind, that he would paint a picture of the hospital that he had come to Virginia Beach to build, a hospital rising like a lighthouse over the sand and sea. Edgar could therefore not have been more pleased and grateful when Morton and Edwin Blumenthal dipped into their personal account in February 1927 to purchase 5 adjoining parcels of land on precisely the spot Edgar envisioned for the hospital. During the 5 years that had elapsed since they'd met Edgar, the Blumenthals had become millionaires. And despite the lack of financial support by the vast majority of association members, the Blumenthals had amassed enough capital to build the hospital themselves. As plans were still being drawn up for the building, the finishing touches were being made to the charter establishing the Association of National Investigators, or ANI, as a legal entity. The ANI would receive its state charter in Virginia on May 6, 1927, as, quote, an association for the purpose of psychic research and to provide for the practical application of any knowledge obtainable through the medium of psychic phenomena, unquote. One of its 10 bylaws required any person requesting a reading to first become a member of the association, which meant acknowledging that the hospital's psychic research was purely experimental. This protected the association and its trustees from legal prosecution for fortune-telling, which was a misdemeanor in the state of Virginia. In the year between the purchase of the land and when construction finally began, in June of 1928, numerous readings were conducted to help fine-tune the blueprints, prepare budgets, obtain the necessary work permits, and order medical equipment that had to be specially made. During the years that had elapsed since the birth of his son, Dr. Thomas House had undergone a serious mental and physical crisis, the result of the reevaluation of his medical practices based on the precepts he had come to know and trust. In early 1926, he decided to turn his life over to the work and become, if Edgar and Morton agreed, the chief doctor in charge of their proposed hospital in Virginia Beach. The board agreed to give the position of chief administrator to Dr. House, who resigned his post in Hopkinsville. He, Carrie, and Tommy moved to the beach along with Edgar's father, Leslie. The first months of construction in the summer and fall of 1928 were marked by an attitude of cooperation and harmony between the Caseys and the Blumenthals. Yet the readings at this time admonished Edgar to enter more deeply into the world of spirit and warned Morton of future problems that might arise from his feelings toward others in the association. As construction continued, Edgar could feel the presence of angels operating far beyond the limited scope of the spiritual financial advisors Elbert Gerry and Felix Fold. These spirits indicated everyone involved in the construction process was on the right track and was doing God's bidding. Perhaps the most dramatic visitation occurred in July of 1928, when an unexpected announcement interrupted a reading that was in progress. Suddenly, the source said, "Hark! There comes the voice of one who would speak to those gathered here." Morton, Gertrude, Gladys, Thomas House, and the others present sat in stunned silence as the Archangel Michael was announced by the source. As Gladys later described it, they could instantly feel a vibrational change in the energy forces around them. She described how the panes of glass in the windows began to shake, and how she felt as if the pad of paper in her hand was being pulled away from her, just as if a gust of wind was blowing through the room. The people sitting in the room could feel the sting of tears in their eyes and shivers up and down their bodies as they sat, frozen in both awe and fear. Then Casey proclaimed in an unusually loud voice, "I am Michael, Lord of the Way. Bend thy head, O ye children of men. Give heed unto the way as is set before you in that Sermon on the Mount. For even as the voice of the one who stood beside the sea and called all men unto the way, that those that would hearken might know there was again a staff in David. For in Zion thy names were written, and in service will come truth. The group sat in silence as the source quietly ended the trance session. Gertrude had to compose herself to attend to Edgar's needs, issuing the usual command to wake up. Edgar stretched and opened his eyes to see every one of them wiping away tears. Although the archangel's words were biblical in content and allusion, their meaning was clear. Those gathered to hear the reading were being given a great opportunity, and also the frightening responsibility, to serve God and their fellow man in a most uncommon way. The money for the hospital, as promised, would be there, but the task that was yet to be accomplished, a task that required something more than hammers and nails, was to develop cooperation between those who would run it. According to the source, some of the participants in the venture had been pitted against each other in their previous incarnations in Egypt, and it was incumbent upon all of them to enter into their work together in a spirit of cooperation. However, this was the beginning of a very tense and troubled period in the association's history. One incident occurred when they were nearly finished, when Morton, wiring them from New York, called a sudden halt to construction. His reason was that the contractor was billing him for approximately twice what he had expected at this stage of the construction. Morton was told that significant alterations had been made to the plans, including adding a bath between each of the 10 second-floor bedrooms and another bathroom in the hall on the third floor. Morton discovered that Edgar had authorized the changes without seeking Morton's permission. Eventually, Morton agreed to go along with the changes, but was visibly angry with Edgar. Up until that point, Edgar had believed that he was in charge of the building operation, but from then on, he stepped aside and let Morton oversee the construction from New York City. The hospital was dedicated on November 11, 1928. Differences were put aside as the Blumenthals, the Caseys, the Kahns, and others proudly looked on the completed building with anticipation. Crowds of Casey supporters from near and far filled the lecture hall. When Morton formally turned the hospital over to the association, Edgar was said to respond, "When your prayers are answered, you find out that prayers are about the only things that words are good for, so there's nothing to say except to give thanks." Although the hospital was dedicated that day, there was still much to be done, and several months passed before the doors were officially opened. On February 11, 1929, they admitted their first patient, Charles Dillman, who was suffering from a chronic sinus condition. 9 days later, after receiving medicinal, osteopathic, and heat treatments, his condition was gone. As Edgar excitedly wrote on February 21st, "Our first patient has already come and gone, cured." Over the next 10 months, over 40 more patients would be admitted, suffering from conditions ranging from tumors to stomach ulcers, gastritis, colitis, syphilis, and optic neuritis. These patients stayed for days, sometimes months, and virtually all were reported to have been cured. Never before had Casey given so many physical readings, and never before had there been so many physicians on hand to treat the patients exactly as the readings recommended. During the first 3 months of the new year, Edgar gave 210 readings, and the waiting list for appointments grew to 2 months long. Difficult years in Dayton, when clients were few and money was tight, seemed gone forever. Casey had every reason to believe that the greatest reward for his gifts was finally at hand. For 30 years, Edgar Casey had delivered his message lying on his back while in trance. In Virginia Beach, in August 1929, he stood on his feet in front of an audience and consciously presented the first of more than 30 lectures he would deliver on topics such as karma, astrology, auras, mental telepathy, and evolution. It was the overwhelming success of these talks that reignited in Morton Blumenthal a dream to establish a college devoted to developing the mind, just as the hospital had been dedicated to healing the body. The result was an institution of higher learning called Atlantic University. Although Edgar himself was credited with the idea of starting Atlantic University, Blumenthal had dreamed about starting his own school since he had attended Columbia University a decade earlier. Morton proposed the idea at the first formal meeting of the Association of National Investigators in early 1927, before the hospital was built. At that time, he outlined a plan to move a pre-existing boys' boarding school to Virginia Beach, but the idea was voted down in favor of first establishing the hospital. No sooner had the hospital become a reality than he presented the idea a second time, and now, with Edgar giving his own lectures, he had a far grander vision of what could be accomplished. He envisioned a school with academic prestige and stately, ivy-covered buildings, which would offer what now might be termed a New Age curriculum. One board member, inventor and auto parts manufacturer Tim Brown, himself an experienced teacher, had certain reservations about Blumenthal's plan from the outset. He initially voted against Morton's proposal, as did Dave Kahn. In their opinion, the ANI had its hands full with the hospital, and the added complications of opening a university would be a logistical nightmare. Although he traditionally supported all of Morton's initiatives, Edgar couldn't in good faith dismiss Brown and Kahn's concerns. A university would be as costly an undertaking as a hospital, and he, like Brown and Kahn, couldn't afford to put his signature on a banknote. Rather than haggle with the board members, Morton put forth a revised proposition, which stated that he and his brother would foot the entire bill. The ANI would operate the university as an adjunct to the Casey Hospital, but all financial decisions would be taken care of by the Blumenthals. The board decided in favor of Morton chairing a newly formed educational board, composed of himself, his brother Edwin, and Tim Brown, which would develop and operate a university. The educational board would answer to no one but its own members. Edgar had no real voice in the board's decisions, but his lack of involvement was neither a matter of his tight schedule at the hospital nor his initial reluctance due to the financial commitment. The truth, as later became apparent, was that Morton didn't consider Edgar Casey an educated man. In Morton's memoirs, he repeatedly pointed out that Edgar had no schooling to speak of, and that it was he, Morton, who had raised the psychic out of what he termed obscurity. In September, less than a month after the educational board had been formed, Morton and Tim Brown held a luncheon meeting in Dayton with Dr. William Moseley Brown, Hugh Lynn's former professor at Washington and Lee, who had delivered the commencement address at the dedication of the Casey Hospital. Dr. Brown's reason for meeting with Morton and Tim was to raise money to make a run on the Republican ticket for governor of Virginia. Morton had something else in mind, making him the first president of what he referred to as his university. Morton knew that Dr. Brown did not have the clout needed to defeat Democratic incumbent Harry Byrd for the governorship. Brown's campaign, Morton believed, would be over before it had started. Morton's enthusiasm for starting a university was contagious. Before the end of their brief meeting, Dr. Brown agreed to become the university's first president at the annual salary of $10,000, regardless of the outcome of the election. Morton didn't initially share this good news with anyone other than Edwin and Tim Brown, not even Edgar. Had they made their plans public, controversies that later erupted around the proposed curriculum and Edgar's involvement with the university might have been avoided. By the time Dr. Brown's appointment became formal in August 1929, it was already clear that there was no coordinated effort to clarify what the university's policy and aims were to be, let alone where the campus should be erected. Without consulting either Dr. Brown or seeking a reading, Morton had hired the respected architect Lawrence B. Emmons to design two buildings, one to house administrative offices and the other for classrooms. The property he chose consisted of two lots situated between the hospital and beach, across Atlantic Boulevard. In keeping with the locale, Blumenthal now gave his institution a name: Atlantic University. While the blueprints for the school were still being drawn up, Morton set the date for the school's opening, the fall of 1930. Since construction would not be finished by then, he decided to rent office space in Virginia Beach to serve as classrooms until the campus was completed. Unbeknownst to Morton, Dr. Brown was also putting together a faculty and curriculum. Brown was excited and impatient to get started, and had his own vision of the physical grounds and academic environment that was to become Atlantic University. Just how far afield Dr. Brown's plans were from Morton's became evident in an article published that August in the Norfolk, Virginian Pilot. In an interview given by Dr. Brown, who had now given up on his bid for the governorship, he described a traditional liberal arts education leading to a bachelor's degree in the arts and sciences. No mention was made of psychic studies. Morton was flabbergasted upon reading the report and called for an emergency meeting of the educational board. No notes remain from the meeting, but it resulted in another newspaper story in the New York Times, as well as editorials in the Norfolk, Virginian Pilot. Dr. Brown now announced an alternative course of study for Atlantic University. Exactly what these alternative courses would consist of, however, was not clear. But rumors suggested that Morton was demanding courses in clairvoyance and spiritualism. Brown and Blumenthal eventually resolved this issue. Atlantic University would offer the standard regimen of pre-law, pre-engineering, and pre-medicine programs, along with a special elective study program in a research center for psychic study. Brown told reporters, "The approach will be entirely scientific, and the same general methods will be used as are utilized in all of the other sciences." Brown added that the board was most emphatically not interested in spiritualism, mediumism, clairvoyance, or any of the other commonly known quackeries. It was now Edgar's turn to feel slighted. Although he never viewed himself as a spiritualist or medium, he couldn't exactly deny that this was what he was doing. The inference that the activities taking place across the street from the proposed site of Atlantic University could be lumped together with quackery shocked him. The tone of Morton's correspondence regarding this issue also didn't help matters. In Morton's own mind, it seemed, the work in Virginia Beach was being separated into two discrete endeavors, as indeed it later would. As Morton said of their respective roles, "It looks like you will stand as chief guardian at the gate to the hospital, I at the gate to the university." By way of apology for not including Casey in the decision-making process, Morton added, "I have never lost my affection for you, yours, or the work, nor do I want to usurp any bossy power that in any way would seek to take advantage of anyone. Yet, be patient until I can completely find my own self, which is not so easy in the terrific strain and pressure that is constantly upon me, even from men who would use me to take advantage of the work or of you, and even from my own lower nature." Unquote. However much Morton was feeling the strain of running a brokerage company in New York and building a university in Virginia, Edgar was under an equal, if not greater, strain. He was acting, by default, as the administrator at the hospital, while at the same time giving readings and explaining them to doctors and patients alike. And then, in late September of 1929, Dr. House became ill with colitis and had to be admitted as a patient in his own hospital. Not only was House's condition seen by the readings as life-threatening, but the suggested treatments required a trained osteopath. Dr. House, in no condition to treat himself, had to be sent to Dayton, where the readings indicated he was to be put under the care of Dr. Lyman Liddick. Accompanying Dr. House was his wife Carrie, who naturally wished to comfort and aid her husband in his time of need. Thus, the Casey Hospital not only lost its resident physician and chief medical administrator, but the head of its nursing and housekeeping staff. The people who came to Edgar's aid included his father Leslie, who began doing chores at the hospital, and Annie Casey, Edgar's only unmarried sister, who took over Carrie House's duties. They were later joined by Gladys's cousin, Mildred Davis, from Oklahoma City, and Lyndon Schroyer from Miami, who came to help run business affairs and to begin the long and arduous task of cataloging the growing volumes of readings and other hospital records. On October 12, 1929, after months of being bedridden, Dr. House, aged 62, died of kidney failure, and was later buried in the plot that had once been reserved for the infant Tommy House. Edgar joined Carrie House in Hopkinsville for the funeral, sharing her sorrow at his passing, and trying to convince her to return with him to Virginia Beach. But Carrie, perhaps the person who had unceasingly and compassionately supported the work longer than anyone else, decided to retire and live out the rest of her years at the Hill. As much as she desired to help Edgar and Gertrude meet the challenges that she knew would face them, she felt she couldn't continue her duties at the hospital without the companionship of her husband. And challenges there were. Foremost among them was the void that resulted from Dr. House's passing. Osteopaths, who were also medical doctors, were in short supply, and it was next to impossible to find one who was also an experienced interpreter of the readings. For 2 months, several were tried and then let go. Finally, in late December 1929, Dr. Lyman Liddick was convinced to move from Dayton and take over for Dr. House. But as Edgar and Morton were later to note, however skilled Liddick was as a physician, osteopath, and administrator, he lacked a spiritual understanding of the readings. He would no more pray at a patient's bedside than he would enact a treatment on faith, as Dr. House and Carey had consistently done. Unless the treatment recommended in the readings agreed with his own, Liddick wouldn't prescribe it. Edgar, morose and distracted, began suffering from neuritis and, for the first time, had to wear glasses due to eye strain. This, no doubt, was the result of spending an increased number of hours at the hospital sorting out the books and making do without Dr. House and Carey. Along with Lyndon Schroyer, Edgar was also attempting to collect money from former patients. No one, it seemed, had been watching the accounts. Approximately half of the patients who had been admitted either didn't have the money to pay for their visits or hadn't kept their accounts up to date. It wasn't long before Morton asked for a more detailed accounting of hospital expenses. Unhappy with what he received, Morton requested that expenses be cut and efforts be made to keep the budget in line with revenue. The problem, from his point of view, was that there was no single person in charge of business affairs, nor was there a central person in charge of purchasing supplies for the hospital, which resulted in a duplication of efforts and cost overruns. Although Edgar promised Morton and Edwin to put the books in order, there is no evidence that he did anything other than recommend that Leslie Casey, or someone else, be hired as a central purchasing agent. And as one new hospital administrator after another was tried out, then let go, the situation only became worse. And, in the midst of these crises, Morton and Dr. Brown still couldn't agree about the university faculty, or what they were hired to teach. As Atlantic University came closer to opening its doors, lack of cooperation, especially in regard to financial matters, continued to be a source of great discord. Adding to the problems, news reached the Atlantic University offices that William and Mary, the finest private college in the state, had announced plans to expand their campus and begin holding classes in Norfolk. Hopes of increasing enrollment were instantly dashed. In the fall of 1930, when the first class of 209 students arrived at the two Virginia Beach hotels that served as the boys' and girls' dormitories, Atlantic University offered a curriculum consisting of 30 courses taught by 20 teachers. This amounted to approximately one teacher for every 10 students, and 7 students per class. The timing could not have been worse for the university, the hospital, or the Blumenthals. That first year, more than 40% of the incoming students would be unable to make their tuition payments, and over half the patients at the hospital would be unable to pay for services received. And as Dr. Brown greeted his freshman class during an assembly held at the Presbyterian Church, the Great Depression loomed like a storm cloud over the proceedings. Exactly how much money the Blumenthals lost during the Depression varies dramatically, depending on whom one believes. Hugh Lynn Casey claimed that the Blumenthals lost over $1 million and in the mid-1930s became destitute and were forced into menial labor. Morton claimed that their losses were closer to $100,000 and that they rode out the Depression in style. The fact that he and his brother didn't lose their seat on the exchange until 1937 and that Morton and Edwin respectively took trips to Europe and Havana just a few months after the stock market crash, is evidence that their losses probably weren't as devastating as Hugh Lynn believed. And yet, Morton's account of the events that transpired immediately prior to and following the stock market crash are in striking contrast to the records that do exist. Morton and his brother made repeated claims in the years after the crash that the trance readings Edgar Cayce gave them didn't so much as hint at the events to come. They said it was the physical and business readings in the wake of the crash that led them to become disillusioned with Cayce, and unable, in good faith, to continue to take his trance advice seriously, or support any endeavor associated with him. Blumenthal later told a journalist, "I have often wondered if the money-crazed era of the 20s didn't have some effect on Cayce. People were making fortunes overnight, and Cayce himself had moved rather quickly from the edge of poverty into a world of money and material plenty. It is just possible that this was the cause of some of his inconsistencies. At any rate, his psychic gifts seemed never to benefit his benefactors, and they let me down at the moment when they could have been the greatest help." Unquote. The reference that Blumenthal made was to October 29, 1929, the day when prices on the exchange dropped 10 points in the early morning, and by noon there were no buyers for the stocks being offered. As that day wore on, and the situation drastically worsened, Morton reportedly became frantic. Desperate for an insight into what was happening, Morton reportedly called Virginia Beach and asked Edgar to take the train to New York. Morton claimed to have reserved a hotel room for him and made an appointment for a reading the next morning. According to Morton's account, the subsequent reading indicated that the worst was over. The bottom had been reached in stock prices, and the market would stabilize and soon start up again. Morton reported that it was his own idea to get out of the market that day, not Edgar Cayce's. And had he not taken immediate action, in direct contradiction to the readings, he would surely have been bankrupted as the market continued to plunge. Evidence in the archival record does not support any of Morton Blumenthal's claims. Throughout the summer and fall of 1929, Morton and his brother received numerous readings suggesting that an upheaval in the market was imminent. Morton had, in fact, traveled to Virginia Beach by train on October 26, 1929, for the express purpose of clarifying the latest warning of impending disaster. During that session, Cayce, in trance, said that one of Blumenthal's largest accounts could be wiped out the next day. The source also advised that it was best to sell and then buy back at a lower price at a later date. Due to the fact that the Blumenthal trading records were later destroyed, it is impossible to know for certain whether or not Morton and his brother acted on the advice given on October 26. All that can be said with certainty was that Morton returned to New York that night or early the next morning and did not contact Edgar again until the market had begun its steep decline. Edgar was next contacted by telephone in Virginia Beach on November 2, 1929, at which time Morton requested confirmation that he should be out of the market. The advice was the same. Morton was told to stay out of the market for the next few days, at which time he and his brother would be given further instructions. A subsequent trip Edgar made to New York, which Morton referred to in his memoirs as having taken place at the end of October, didn't actually occur until November 15th. The reading conducted there began with a reminder to Morton and Edwin that the union they represented with Cayce would be envied by many, and that it was their responsibility to honor the trust that had been given them by remaining steadfast. The source told them, "He that furnisheth bread for the brothers shall control many cities. He that honoreth his God shall not go without full recompense, saith the Lord. For him that I have loved, him will I also raise up. Him that teacheth his brother the right way shall not go unrewarded." Unquote. At this point in the reading, it was clear to the Blumenthals that the spiritual voices of Gary and Fuld, who had regularly communicated through Cayce when asked about the market, were not addressing them. Morton asked if the voice coming through belonged to Jesus. The source replied, "He speaks with thee often in thy meditations and prayers." This indicated to the Blumenthals that Jesus himself was indeed speaking to them, and that they could count on his help if they remained open to and mindful of his communications. Morton and his brother, apparently moved by the message that had come through, closed their session by saying a prayer. Given the archival record of this reading, it is strange that Morton and his brother had such a remarkably different memory of what transpired between them and Edgar after the market crashed. It's extremely unlikely that the existing transcript was forged. This reading was not conducted at Virginia Beach, but in New York, under the Blumenthal's auspices. Edwin was present in the hotel room, Morton was the conductor of the reading, and their company secretary was the stenographer. They kept a copy of the reading for themselves and sent Gladys a duplicate for the ANI records. Morton and his brother received several more readings before taking an extended holiday from their brokerage company, during which time Morton and his family traveled to France and North Africa, and Edwin and his wife went to Havana. In none of these readings, or the accompanying correspondence, is there a hint that they had suffered great losses or felt betrayed by Edgar in regard to the devastated market. Nor, according to the historical record, did they appear to feel misled by a physical reading conducted during this same period, which Morton was later to claim to the press was certifiable evidence that Edgar Cayce had lost his ability to give reliable trance information. The physical reading in question was initially requested on October 7, 1929, for 54-year-old Rosamond Blumenthal, the sister of Morton's mother. She had recently undergone a serious operation at a New York hospital and was not recovering properly. Due to a backlog of requests at the hospital, Edgar was not able to do the reading until October 30th. According to the reading, Rosamond was near death. Her organs were still functioning, but under great distress. In order to build up her strength, she was directed to drink a solution containing wild cherry bark, sarsaparilla root, wild ginger, Indian turnip, ginseng, prickly ash bark, bushu leaves, and mandrake. A copy of the reading was sent to Morton's mother and another to Morton himself. Blumenthal called Cayce on November 2nd to express his surprise at what it contained, for his aunt had died and was buried 3 days before the reading had been conducted. He hadn't told Edgar because he'd been too busy with the activities on the collapsing stock market. Edgar wanted to give another reading to see what might have gone wrong, but Morton didn't think it was necessary. He said he had an idea what might have happened. The work readings had insisted that appointments be definite, and that the individual requesting the reading be in a seeking, meditative attitude at the time of the appointment. Rosamond hadn't even known there was a request for an appointment for the reading, nor would she have approved had she been informed. Nor was she at the location when the reading was requested, because she was already in the grave. And, having studied the reading, it was clear that the diagnosis applied to the patient's condition at the time the reading had been requested, not at the time the reading was given. The only psychic link that Edgar had to Rosamond was the letter that Gertrude held in her hand as she conducted the readings, a letter that was already 23 days old. Rather than reveal a supposed error on the part of Edgar Cayce, Morton said, the reading revealed something of the process of requesting information from the source. Cayce, in trance, literally stepped back in time to examine her condition. Gladys's diaries revealed that Morton didn't appear to be upset by his aunt's reading. His attitude only began to change upon his return from Europe, when his mother and other family members began to question the veracity of Edgar's work and Morton's involvement in it. Morton's mother thought her son foolish to be giving so much of his time and money to a psychic who had made such an obvious blunder. Morton may or may not have concurred, but one thing soon became clear. The upheavals in the market had shaken him and filled him with fear. And instead of turning to Edgar Cayce for help or to his wife, he invited another woman into his life.
Patricia Devlin was an attractive 25-year-old redhead who had first come to Morton's attention in late 1928 when she was a switchboard operator in the building that housed the Blumenthal Brokerage Company. There is no hard evidence that she eavesdropped on the telephone conversations between New York and Virginia Beach, but there is no doubt that she had an intimate knowledge of Morton and Edgar's affairs long before Morton hired her as his personal assistant in 1929. Devlin claimed her source of information was the same psychic channels that Edgar Casey tapped into, and told Morton that she had only to close her eyes to enter a self-induced trance state that permitted her to subconsciously travel to Virginia Beach to see what was going on. Morton later reported discovering in Devlin what he had seen in Edgar Casey back in Dayton, and said he was responsible for developing the precious gift, as he called it, that Devlin allegedly possessed. Exactly when she and Morton's relationship passed beyond that of employee and employer is not clear. By early 1929, she began to accompany Morton to Virginia Beach to help him prepare lectures and take notes for improvements he wished to implement at the hospital. Edgar expressed mild interest in what he termed Morton's protege when they were first introduced and, like Morton, encouraged her to develop her psychic talents. She soon began to take over responsibilities as Morton and Edwin's new source of psychic stock market and business advice. Edgar was relieved to have the pressure of giving Morton and Edwin business readings twice a day taken off his shoulders. The fact that Morton was certain of her powers and the help she could give him and his brother made Edgar all the more pleased. Unlike Edgar Casey, Patricia Devlin could and did remember the information that allegedly came to her during trance sessions, which allowed her to discuss the communications she received in ways that Edgar was unable to do. She also spoke in her normal voice while in trance, in clear, distinct sentences without the repetitious use of pronouns and adverbs that sometimes made Casey's readings difficult to understand. Her plain-spokenness, coupled with her availability to give readings to Morton, both night and day, made her more desirable in many respects than Edgar Casey. His responsibilities at the hospital made it impossible to devote himself to Morton full-time as he had done in the past. The confidence that Morton put in Devlin was apparent everywhere. When Morton and Edwin took their trips abroad in early 1930, Devlin was placed in charge of managing the hospital. There is no evidence to suggest that Edgar or Gertrude particularly minded Devlin being temporarily put in charge of hospital affairs. Edgar's main difficulty was abiding by Morton's request, made at Devlin's suggestion, that he limit the number of readings given to patients who were unable or unwilling to pay for them. In a letter he wrote to Morton on January 13, 1930, Edgar found himself in the uncomfortable position of having to justify the fact that he couldn't abide by Morton's edict. He wrote, "No one can control the readings. You and I may be able to control the times when we will give the readings, but who they are going to be for and when they are going to be given, the minute we do that, we have lost the very foundation of the whole work. Remember, the Master didn't refuse to heal the whole 10 lepers, though only 2 came back and said, 'Thank you.'" Unquote. Morton let the matter drop for the time being, but he and Edgar were still not getting along. And with the introduction of Patricia Devlin, the distance between the two men became considerably greater. Upon Morton's return from Europe on February 16th, Devlin reported what she described as the disillusioning news that Edgar was taking him for a financial ride. Spending hadn't been cut at the hospital. Furthermore, Devlin's investigation had revealed a large number of non-paying guests living at the hospital whose contributions to the work she found questionable. Among them were Gladys's cousin, Mildred Davis, who was helping with the secretarial work, and Leslie Casey, who had moved into an upstairs room at the hospital. There were also 2 of Edgar's sisters, Annie Casey and Sarah Casey Hessen, who came to the hospital to fill in for Carrie House. Morton called an emergency meeting at the hospital that same month. The meeting didn't get off to a good start. As Morton's party walked up the path to the front of the hospital, one of Devlin's high heels caught on something buried in the grass. It was a pipe that ran from the hospital waterline to a private home adjacent to the recently completed nurse's building. Edgar was called in to look at the pipe and admitted that he had let a neighbor tap into the hospital water supply rather than have the man go to the trouble and expense of finding his own water source. The hospital, Edgar acknowledged, was not being compensated for their largesse. Upon Devlin's recommendation, Morton stopped paying all the hospital's bills until the accounts were put into order. "I'm just not that good a businessman," Edgar admitted when confronted by Devlin's accounting. "It certainly does get my goat to do my level best, and then find I have fallen far short of what should be done." However justified the Blumenthals were in accusing Edgar of extravagance, it was not an extravagance characterized by fancy cars, beautiful homes, or any sort of material excess. The extravagance that Edgar was guilty of was charity. His goal all along had been to give away his services in any way he could, and it was often beyond his ability to ask for money in return. Put simply, Edgar couldn't bring himself to demand payment for what he believed to be a gift from God. By December of 1930, the Blumenthals had stopped paying the hospital's bills, claiming that Edgar and the others were doing nothing to curb expenses. Morton fired Lyndon Schroyer and put Dr. Job Taylor in direct charge of all hospital bookkeeping and disbursements. Perhaps even more serious, patients returning after the Christmas holidays found the doors temporarily closed to them while Morton and Dr. Taylor evaluated the current status of the hospital accounts. At a meeting shortly afterward, on February 28, 1931, they would close the hospital doors forever. At that meeting, Morton gave a brief review of the financial history of the hospital. He then listed $10,000 worth of outstanding bills that had accumulated. Finally, he proposed that the ANI board formally turn the hospital property and all its assets over to him and his brother, as a prerequisite for settling all outstanding ANI bills. The motion was voted down. Morton lost his temper. He threatened to force an immediate closing of the hospital. Edgar then took the floor, and during what Hugh Lynn described as the simplest and most beautiful speech his father ever made, assured Morton of his faith and confidence in him. Edgar told him that if he wanted the hospital and its property, that he would like to return them to him, that they would mean little without Morton's interest and cooperation. "Morton has given the property, and if he needs it, we should turn it back to him," Edgar said. A second vote put the hospital property into the hands of the Blumenthals, the deciding vote being cast by Tim Brown. He believed that there was no point in continuing operations unless Edgar desired to be in charge. Less than a month later, a second board meeting was held in New York, in which the papers were signed that closed the hospital and disbanded the Association of National Investigators. It was only a matter of months before the university, similarly beset with financial problems and personal conflicts, also closed its doors. In doing so, it left many of its professors and students stranded in the middle of a school year, without any place to go. As had occurred back in Hopkinsville 3 decades before, a partnership that had begun with the best of intentions ended up in court. David Kahn, irate that the Blumenthals should blackmail the hospital board into turning the ANI's assets over to them, sued Morton and Edwin on behalf of Edgar Casey and the association for the return of the property. In a separate proceeding, Patricia Devlin sued David Kahn on behalf of Morton and Edwin for financial notes that he had countersigned for the hospital property and for stock options he had purchased on margin before the crash. Then Morton and Edwin sued Edgar in another civil suit for several $100 they claimed Edgar had drawn in unauthorized expenses in the final months of the hospital's decline. Edgar and Morton met for the last time on April 11, 1932, at the Princess Anne County Courthouse. Standing in the witness box, Edgar admitted that Morton had provided the money for the house he was living in, as well as the hospital, whose assets had been turned over to the Blumenthals during a legitimate board meeting held by the ANI, of which Morton was then president. the judge settled the ANI case in favor of the Blumenthals. Another judge, in 1937, decided against Kahn for the $7,500 owed the Blumenthal Brokerage Company. Edgar and Morton never spoke again. Letters that Edgar wrote asking for a reconciliation went unanswered. The Blumenthals wasted no time in liquidating what remained of the institution. They assigned Patricia Devlin to fire the staff, cart away the records, and for pennies on the dollar, dismantle and sell the equipment. Days later, as a crew of carpenters arrived to turn the hospital building into a hotel, Morton dispatched a sheriff to the Casey home with an eviction notice. Already involved in two lawsuits over the hospital's closure, Edgar wasn't about to initiate a third by fighting to keep the home he believed rightfully belonged to him and Gertrude. Rentals were costly and hard to find at the height of the tourist season, and all the Caseys found within their price range was a drafty summer cottage at the foot of 105th Street, which looked out over the ocean on one side, and on the other side, the now-defunct Casey Hospital. Meanwhile, Gladys and other supporters of Casey's work had gone into action, hoping to recapture the momentum of their early years. Hundreds of letters were sent out notifying Casey supporters of what had happened and asking their help in forming an association to replace the ANI. At a meeting held in the Casey living room on March 28, 1931, the decision was made to name the new organization the Association for Research and Enlightenment, or the ARE. In October 1931, Gladys and the Caseys traveled to New York, where Dave Kahn and other association members had arranged for a series of physical readings. Casey hoped that these readings would generate sufficient funds to tide them through the holiday season. The appointment calendar was full for their entire two-week stay at the Victoria Hotel, and a lecture Edgar gave at the Theosophical Society garnered them many new supporters. The curtain fell, however, on November 7th, the day they planned to give two final readings before setting off for Virginia Beach. Their trouble began when their 3 o'clock appointment was suddenly canceled, and Gladys agreed to an unscheduled reading for a hotel guest registered as Bertha Gorman. She had been begging for help from Edgar for several days and was offering 3 times the normal fee for membership in the ARE. Mrs. Gorman and her companion, Mrs. Anna McNamara, were vague about how they heard about Edgar Casey, or who exactly had recommended that she obtain a reading. All the 45-year-old subject of the reading said about herself was that she was an unemployed widow from Wilmington, Delaware, who was visiting the city to consult with doctors about an undisclosed ailment. There was nothing particularly unusual about their behavior, except that neither she nor her companion wanted to sign the application to the association. Gertrude explained that signing was required, that Edgar gave trance readings under a Virginia-based charter that stipulated that only members could have readings. The trance reading wouldn't be given without their signatures. Mrs. Gorman and Mrs. McNamara read the application and allegedly signed it. The reading was unusual in 2 significant ways. Unlike the vast majority of other readings, the source was unusually vague about what exactly was ailing Mrs. Gorman. All the source indicated was that the root of her problems lay less in the physical and more in the spiritual. Mrs. Gorman should, the reading stated, clarify her ideals and not let her material needs become her guiding principles. The source further stated that Mrs. Gorman suffered from loneliness, alienation, and lack of faith, and these were termed as being of more concern than any physical difficulties. Another curious aspect of the reading occurred when Mrs. Gorman asked about her sister's health. The source said no sister could be found. The truth, as it was later revealed in court, was that the woman calling herself Mrs. Gorman didn't have a sister. No sooner had the reading ended than Mrs. Gorman and her companion announced that they were undercover policewomen. A detective appeared at the door and arrested Edgar, Gertrude, and Gladys for pretending to tell fortunes. To add to the indignity, someone had tipped off the press. As Edgar, Gertrude, and Gladys left the police station later that night, released on bail, a photographer from the New York Daily News snapped their picture. This is the end of Side 7. Please fast forward and turn over the tape for proper cueing of Side 8.